Great, so let's get started. So what I'm going to do today is... That's all right. They don't want to look at me anyway. Let's look at that. what we're going to do today is... yesterday I suggested that possibly Dawkins' central argument against what he calls the God hypothesis might not be that good an argument. And certainly there are some interesting questions which have been raised about it, and I think some of the most telling comments have come from Plantinga. I think I'm not entirely sure Plantinga has succeeded in refuting Dawkins, but he might have done. He might have succeeded in refuting that particular argument. I need to go away and think about it a bit more. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to give you a different argument against the existence of God. It's one of my favourite arguments. I think possibly it's the very best argument that there is against the existence of God, although there are some other really quite good arguments as well, which possibly I'll have a chance to mention later on. So, to begin, before we look at the argument, I want very briefly to do something that Dawkins also does in his book, which is just to get a little bit clearer about notions such as proof and confirmation and reasonableness. It seems to me that reasonableness comes in degrees, in the sense that beliefs can be more or less reasonable. Some beliefs are very reasonable indeed, some beliefs are fairly reasonable, some beliefs are downright unreasonable. So there is, if you like, a scale of reasonableness. You might imagine it being a sort of a vertical scale on which you can locate beliefs in terms of just how reasonable they are. So let's think about that scale. Japan exists, for example. I would put that pretty high up on the scale of reasonableness. Despite the fact that I've never been to Japan, and I've never seen it with my own eyes. But some of you claim to have done, I imagine, yes. Who's been to Japan? One or two of you? Several, well, quite a few of you have been to Japan. Was that? No, no. No, it wasn't the veracity of your memory that was I was questioning. No, it'll become clear why I said that in a minute. here's the thing about Japan. There's plenty of evidence that it exists. I have plenty of evidence that it exists. There are maps of the world on which it appears in the top left-hand corner of the Pacific Ocean. I've met people who claim to come from Japan. I've bought goods stamped made in Japan. I've eaten in Japanese restaurants. People claim to have been to Japan and so on. So I have extremely good evidence that Japan exists, despite the fact that I've never seen it. I've never come across any evidence that it doesn't exist, that it is all some sort of elaborate conspiracy constructed by the CIA. So it's an eminently reasonable belief for me to hold, and yet I could be wrong. There is the possibility, however remote, that I am mistaken. Maybe there really is some sort of CIA-led conspiracy, and several of the people in this room are in on it, including this lady down here, who claims to have been to Japan.
But you would then be mad as a hatter.
I would indeed be mad as a hatter, yes. So it's possible that I am mistaken. In fact, even if I thought I'd been there, I could still be mistaken. Did any of you see that program called Space Cadets, which I think was on Channel 4 a few years ago? None of you, probably, because you're all too sensible. On the program, they took some young people and they told them that they were going to go into space on a spaceship. They were going to be taken to a Russian space base and shown the spaceship and given 2 weeks of training. And they would then be taken up in the spaceship, and they would see the Earth from space, and they would also have the opportunity of doing a spacewalk. So they took these kids, and they took them up in an aircraft and they flew them to a big barn in Lowestoft, which had been a big hangar, which they'd been kitted out with a lot of Russian stuff, you know, Russian words on the taps. And then they got a lot of fake training, and then they were put into a flight simulator and told that this was the spacecraft, and the trip up into space was simulated, and you know, they take off, and they see the Earth from space. So it's all carefully arranged. They make sure they can't get too close, so they can't see too much detail, but they get to see it. And then finally, they get to do their spacewalk, and as they step out of the spaceship, they step out in front of a studio audience of people who say, you know, gotcha, basically. It was all an elaborate ruse. So some of these people were, it seems, taken in. It's hard to believe, isn't it? But they were taken in. And so I could be taken in, perhaps, you know, even if I thought I'd been to Japan, I'd only visited a great big hangar in Lowestoft. You know, it's possible. We can be mistaken. We can be duped. So just because something is very reasonable indeed doesn't mean that it is impossible for me to be mistaken. Is it proved? It depends what you mean by proved, doesn't it? I mean, proved beyond all possible doubt? No, I can't prove beyond all possible doubt that Japan exists. Even if I thought I'd been there, I could still be mistaken. There is still the possibility of a doubt being raised in my mind. Perhaps there is that CIA-led conspiracy or whatever. Proved beyond reasonable doubt? Yeah, I would say so. I would say I have proof beyond reasonable doubt that Japan exists. So that's high on the scale of reasonableness, pretty high up. Let's now consider a belief that's pretty low. Fairies exist. There's always somebody in the audience who insists that it's not that unreasonable, but I think most of us probably would agree that fairies exist is pretty unreasonable. No real evidence that they do exist, plenty of evidence that it's just a lot of nonsense made up to amuse the children. And yet, we could be wrong. You know, there is no evidence of fairies down the bottom of the garden, but perhaps they're just very secretive. Perhaps they're invisible. They only come out at night. They live in deep underground bunkers, and so on. There are all sorts of explanations I could come up with in order to try and deal with the absence of evidence and show that somehow belief in fairies is not so unreasonable after all. But the fact is, it really is very unreasonable. Indeed, and the mere fact that we could be mistaken doesn't mean that it's not overwhelmingly the reasonable thing to believe that there are no fairies at the bottom of the garden. Can I prove there are no fairies at the bottom of the garden? Well, I can't prove beyond all possible doubt that there are no fairies. Perhaps they really do live in deep underground bunkers and only come out at night. But I can surely prove beyond reasonable doubt that there are no fairies at the bottom of the garden. And then in the middle of the scale, so they're down the bottom of the scale of reasonableness, and then in the middle of the scale we've got beliefs such as there is extraterrestrial intelligence out there somewhere in the universe. How reasonable is that? Well, it's not that unreasonable, because we know that intelligent life has appeared on this planet, has evolved. We know that there are literally billions of planets quite like this one out there. And so it's not that unlikely, surely, that there is some other intelligence out there. On the other hand, we don't have any direct evidence of it. And perhaps there are some grounds for supposing that there isn't any out there. So I'm not sure. Maybe it's in the middle of the scale. You know, it's 50-50. It's hard. It's certainly very hard to be sure that it definitely is there or that it definitely isn't there. So beliefs can be arranged on the scale of reasonableness. Notice that one of the reasons I like the scale of reasonableness is that it retains a lot of information which can quite quickly be lost if instead of using the scale of reasonableness, you use a three-box system of classification: proved, disproved, neither proved nor disproved. Right? If you use the three-box system of classifying beliefs, you will very rapidly lose an awful lot of information concerning reasonableness. First of all, what does proved and disproved mean? Does it mean proved beyond all possible doubt, disproved beyond all possible doubt? Then there's hardly anything in those two boxes, right? And everything gets lumped in the middle box. Does that mean that everything in the middle box is equally reasonable? No, it doesn't. But the three-box system removes that information. We can't see it anymore. It's been removed from the presentation, which is, some people might consider that to their advantage, shall we say, to use them, the three-box system. Even if we're talking about proved beyond reasonable doubt, again, even if I can't prove something beyond reasonable doubt, it might still be a fairly reasonable thing to believe. It might still be a very reasonable thing to believe, despite the fact that I can't prove it beyond reasonable doubt. Again, you're losing all of that information if you merely chuck those beliefs into the middle box. So the you can't prove it either way move that you so often hear presented when people give arguments for or against the existence of God, it seems to me that probably you can't prove it conclusively beyond all doubt, one way or the other, but that is to overlook the fact that actually you might have extremely good grounds for supposing either that there is a God or that there isn't a God, and pointing out that you can't prove it either way fails to deal with those kind of arguments and that kind of evidence. It's a way of trying to suppress it using the three-box system. So that's why I'm using the scale of reasonableness rather than the three-box system. So the big question, of course, is, well, where are we going to stick God exists? On the scale of reasonableness, when it comes to Japan, we all agree, pretty high up the scale. When it comes to electrons, exist, pretty high up the scale. When it comes to fairies, pretty low down on the scale. When it comes to God, suddenly we're all over the place, which is interesting, isn't it? Some people will put, Richard Dawkins down near the fairies. God exists is down near the bottom of the scale, near belief in fairies. Whereas other people will put it at least in the middle range, near ET. And then some people will put it higher than that, perhaps as high as Japan exists. So it's kind of interesting that there is such a range of opinion about how reasonable a belief it is. What I want to draw your attention to is that most theists, most people who believe in God, think that their belief is not unreasonable. I mean, have you ever met somebody who says, you know what, I believe in God, but it's no more reasonable than believing in fairies? I mean, that would be a very, very odd position for someone to take, wouldn't it? And I've never heard anyone take it. People who believe in God, they'll say, oh, you can't prove it. You know, there's no proof either way. But still, they think it's not an unreasonable thing to believe, so they're sticking their belief at least halfway up the scale of reasonableness. And there's a question now about whether they're right to put it that high up the scale of reasonableness. We can look at the arguments, we can look at the evidence. We need to be careful because there are various factors that come into play which affect reasonableness, and it's not necessarily all about evidence. Sometimes atheists are accused of a position called evidentialism, which is that only evidence, empirical evidence, counts. So, and I wouldn't like to be accused of that. I don't want to sign up to that. It seems to me that it might be reasonable for someone to believe something, not because they have evidence that it's true, but just because they can see it, right? There's a Coke can on the table. It's a reasonable belief for me to have. Do I infer that the Coke can is there on the basis of evidence? Well, some people might argue that I do. But it's contentious. It's a contentious issue in philosophy whether I infer the presence of the Coke can, and that's why it's a rational or reasonable thing for me to believe. Many people would suggest that actually it's not an inference at all. My justification, or the reasonableness of my belief, is not derived from some kind of argument or inference at all. So it might be, some people may claim that their belief in God is reasonable, not because there is evidence for the existence of God, but because they can just experience him in the way that I can experience the Coke can. Some people take that line. It's an interesting argument, and I'm not dismissing it And I'm not saying, oh no, that doesn't count. That's not allowed. You're not allowed to raise that so far as reasonableness is concerned. I will allow them to do that, in fact. But we'll have to come back to that a bit later on. So, most theists think that their belief is not unreasonable. That is to say, it's at least halfway up the scale of reasonableness. I don't think that it is. You won't be surprised to hear. And so I'll give you some reasons why. First of all, let's clarify which God hypothesis we're going to be considering, because it's a slightly richer God hypothesis than the one Dawkins considers. I'm adding in certain characteristics of God. All powerful, supremely powerful, maximally powerful, and all good and loving, supremely benevolent. These are properties which God is supposed to have. If you're Orthodox Jew or Christian or Muslim, this is what you're supposed to believe about God, that he has these God properties.
The issue with that one. Yes. A lot of Muslims believe that God is all good and loving towards Muslims, but not towards everybody else.
I'm not an expert on... you may be right, for all I know. well, let's just stick with the Christians. Sorry?
Most at the beginning.
Yes.
A lot of Jews argue...
That should say most, actually. I think what's happened there is it used to say most, and then I removed it. There are certainly some Christians who would be uncomfortable with this way of characterising their belief. So this is I've oversimplified on the slide here. However, very very many Jews and Christians and Muslims sign up to this, and certainly if you were to ask a philosopher like Richard Swinburne, who's a Christian, he believes in God. If you ask him what kind of God do you believe in, Richard, he says, oh, it's a person. And it's all good, and it's all powerful. These are God properties that he thinks that this particular being has. So it is that particular hypothesis that we're considering here. And if there are other God hypotheses you want to consider, we might have a chance to come back to those later on. So that the one that you've just mentioned, nice to Muslims, but not nice to everyone else, or that one, we can perhaps come back to that one. So that's the God hypothesis I'm looking at. So it's clearly it's a little bit richer than Dawkins' God hypothesis. Many think this is a fairly reasonable thing to believe, that there is such a being. The first thing I'll point out is that I don't say all, there are some exceptions, but most of the most popular arguments for the existence of God actually provide us with no grounds at all for supposing that the first cause or prime mover or necessary being or designer or whatever it is is all-powerful and all-good, supremely benevolent. Fine-tuning arguments, for example, merely suggest that there's, at best, some sort of intelligent designer. The universe is the creation of perhaps a being, even if it's a god, an intelligent god. Why an all-good one? The argument itself provides no grounds for supposing that this being is all good, any more than it provides grounds for supposing that it is, say, all evil. I mean, it's just completely neutral so far as the moral properties of this being are concerned. The same goes with standard cosmological arguments. So there's a first cause, a prime mover, a necessary being. Why suppose that it's all good rather than, say, all evil or neither good nor evil, lacking moral properties? What justification have we for adding that further property? The answer is none whatsoever, so far as those particular arguments are concerned. They simply fail to provide any justification at all for making that leap to the further conclusion that it's the Judeo-Christian God as traditionally conceived that we are talking about. Yep.
Your premise is actually wrong there. If you take the fine-tuning argument, it isn't an argument that is used to establish the existence of God. It is one of a number of arguments taken together, but yeah. It is not an initial argument. I mean, going back.
I wasn't suggesting that everyone who runs the fine-tuning argument thinks that it is an argument for the existence of God. Actually, many of them, if you ask them, will say, "Oh, actually, no, it's not. It's merely an argument for the existence of some kind of intelligence." And then I've got some other reasons for supposing that this intelligence is, say, the Judeo-Christian God. Yeah, absolutely. No, you're quite right about that. But some people who run the fine-tuning argument do jump straight from, "Oh, there's a designer," to, "And it's my particular God," seamlessly, without any further argument. And of course, they're not justified in making that leap. That's the only point I'm making here. The argument by itself fails to justify that particular additional move. Yep.
And I think the scholastics get around this problem by saying that they find good not from a human point of view, but I think primary good is existence itself. So a being who is itself existence must necessarily be good, not from a human point of view, but from a existence, a creator existence point of view.
Yeah, I'll come back to that kind of worry. Raise that a bit later on, because raise that a bit later. Let me. So my first point is this: that many, I don't say all, because there are some exceptions, but many of the classic arguments for the existence of God fail to provide us by themselves with any reason to suppose that it's, say, a supremely good being rather than a supremely evil one or a morally neutral one. So. Worse still, there's a very powerful-looking argument against the existence of this particular God. And, of course, I'm talking about the problem of evil, as it's known. Why is there so much suffering in the world? Cancer, the Holocaust, the Black Death, and hemorrhoids I've frivolously added to try and lighten the mood. Thousands of children buried alive to die over days and weeks. Hundreds of millions of years of, literally unimaginable quantities of horror, of pain and suffering and anguish unleashed on the sentient inhabitants of this planet. Mass extinction events, the second to last of which wiped out 95% of all species from the face of the Earth. An awful lot of pain and suffering. Isn't this excellent evidence that if the universe is designed, is the creation of some sort of cosmic being, that this cosmic being is not particularly benevolent, is certainly not, you know, supremely benevolent. Isn't it very good evidence indeed? On the face of it, you might think that it is. I want to be clear, though, which version of the problem of evil I'm running here, because there are two problems of evil. There's something called the logical problem of evil, and then there's the evidential problem of evil, and it's really important that we separate them out. They are not the same problem, and I think one is a much bigger problem than the other one. The logical problem is this. Evil exists, we can observe it. If evil exists, God does not, because God, being all-powerful, would not allow it to exist, given that he desires that it not exist, right? Therefore, given that evil exists, God does not exist. Very simple, straightforward argument. That's the logical problem. The idea is that the existence of evil logically entails that there is no God. It doesn't matter how much evil there is, so far as this argument is concerned. Even if there's just a teeny tiny amount, that's enough to do the trick. That shows that there is no God. That's the logical problem. That's not the problem that I'm running here, the logical problem. You can respond to the logical problem by, for example, suggesting that certain evils are the price that has to be paid for certain greater goods that outweigh those evils. In which case, God will put the evils in to the world so that he can have that greater good. It will be a better world. Sounds paradoxical, but it's true, those who take this line, with some evil in it, because of the greater good that that little bit of evil then allows. So you can run that kind of argument against in order to deal with this particular problem. And perhaps it works. I'm not saying here that it doesn't. Okay. So that's the logical problem of evil. The The problem I'm looking at is the evidential problem of evil. The evidential problem is this. There are huge quantities of suffering, much of it seemingly pointless, gratuitous. God, if he exists, would not allow pointless suffering. He might allow some suffering, he might allow some evil for the sake of a greater good, but he's not going to allow pointless, gratuitous suffering, suffering for which there is no reason. There does appear to be an awful lot of it. Therefore, God does not exist. Now, this argument is evidential. The idea is that not that the existence of this evil logically entails that there is no God, but that it provides us with very powerful evidence that there is no God. And the more of it that there is, the more of a problem there is so far as belief in God is concerned. The more apparent, pointless suffering there is, the greater the challenge to theism, because the more explaining they've got to do.
How can we be sure that the suffering is pointless?
Yeah, well, how can we be sure there's any fairy, there are no fairies at the bottom of the garden? I will come back to that point.
What do you mean by pointless suffering anyway? Because that's meaningless as it stands at the moment.
Well, suffering for which, if there is a God, suffering for which there would be no reason.
For example?
Darwin is an example it's a wasp that lays an egg in a moth, and the moth has this excruciating death while the larvae develop. What would that have to do with moral consequences of human beings?
Yeah. Of course, it's always possible to gerrymander some kind of explanation. We'll be coming to that. It's always possible to say, well, you see, you know, that's a consequence of certain laws of nature operating. Without those laws of nature, we can't have human beings and we can't have moral agents. And so ultimately, it is all for the best.
Stephen, it's also possible to say, I'll come back to that later.
And I'll do that too, yes. I'll come back to that later as well. But let's look at some moves now that people make in order to try and deal with the evidential problem of evil. And this is an obvious example, isn't it? You could appeal to free will. You could say, why are there terrible wars, terrible suffering? why does God allow this to happen? He could prevent it. He has the power to prevent it. Surely he's not going to want it. So why doesn't he step in? Well, he could step in, he could prevent us doing those kinds of things to each other, but if he did, he would take away our free will. We would then be mere puppet beings. We would be made always to do the right thing and never the wrong thing. But God cut our strings so that we could choose, we could make our own choice as to how to behave. That inevitably allows for evil. We sometimes choose to do the wrong thing. But there is an upside. The upside is that we are then moral agents. We can now be held morally responsible for what we do, which we can't if we're mere puppet beings. And being moral agents then allows for the possibility of moral goods existing in the universe. You can't have moral goodness in the universe unless you have moral agents. You can't have moral agents without free will. So this is a very, very great good, which you cannot have unless God cuts the strings. So this is a move that you might make in order to try and deal with the evidential problem of evil. You might say much of this evil can be accounted for once we realise that God gave us free will for very good reasons. Yeah, I was just about to mention that, yeah. I mean, clearly the free will explanation or theodicy is limited in its scope because it, on the face of it, it can only account for the kind of suffering which we produce by the exercise of our free will. What about natural disasters? What about hundreds of millions of years of animal suffering before we even show up with our free will? How do we explain that? Now, it is possible to develop the free will solution in a way that might allow you to do that, and to explain that other suffering too. And that's effectively what Augustine did. He said that Adam and Eve sinned. They chose to go against God, and their actions corrupted themselves and corrupted nature. There was no death and suffering before they chose to disobey. So actually, even the natural evils, it turns out, are really moral evils after all, and they are really our own fault. It's the fault of humanity. So you could extend this kind of free will solution in that way, but of course it's pretty implausible because it requires, for example, that there be an Adam and Eve, for a start, which there wasn't. And we also know that things like earthquakes happen because of the movements of tectonic plates, and we know that those tectonic plates are going to move whether anyone sins or not, don't we? So, you know, it's just not a very plausible solution. This gentleman here.
When you talk about natural disasters, you talk about events which happen in a timely way, perhaps as a result of natural causes. If you talk about the God that exists within each one of us, the immanent God, we're talking about something, a God, which operates in a completely different way. So therefore, why can there not be a God who acts in one way in regard to nature and in another way in regard to human nature?
Well, this doesn't sound like... How could that be a God, the God that we're talking about? I mean, it sounds to me like you're talking about... I'm not quite sure which God hypothesis you're talking about, but it doesn't sound like a God who is all-powerful and all-good, because an all-powerful and all-good God, presumably, wouldn't unleash enormous amounts of suffering on us.
If one's talking about knowing God... one's talking about knowing God or knowing there is a God. And there's two different things. And I'm referring to knowing God, a knowledge of a God that exists because of your own sense of knowing that God exists for you. But you're talking about a God that is meant to be able to straddle natural disaster and human understanding of things at the same time, which is all very well, but the experience of God in time is contradictory if you're trying to line the human idea of God up with his relationship to human beings. And in the natural, the God in his relationship to nature.
Right.
A natural disaster. Those are two separate things.
But if there is a God... Look, we are considering a very specific God hypothesis, which you're free to reject and say, oh, that's not the one I believe in, or that's not the one I'm talking about. But the one we are considering is that there is a God who created the universe, who designed it, who is all-powerful and all-good. Not any other God hypothesis. I'm not quite sure which one you're considering, but it doesn't appear to be that one. So we can come to that one later on. Let's talk about this one first.
Yeah. Can I ask about evolution? Now,
yes.
Most Christians perfectly happily accept evolution, even the Pope, and therefore officially all the Catholics, and nearly all, most of them.
Most Christians accept the theory of evolution.
I suggest.
Do they?
But things didn't just start. Yes.
I don't know. I just don't know that.
Okay, but what I have to say is, why can't you bring up an argument using today's scientific knowledge? Nearly all the Christians in this country and many others as well, accept evolution. Officially, all the Catholics will, as I said, and evolution isn't the beginning. We can go back to the Big Bang, and the Pope said yes from the Big Bang. So, before even Earth existed, all the atoms and stuff, and therefore, it seems that what you're saying is that you have got to reject the fact that any believers in God have can possibly accept evolution, because accepting that, there's loads of cruelty and so on in that. So you might be saying, you can't believe in an all-good, powerful God who would have set up evolution. Look at the cruelty, look at the waste. Is that what you really are leading round to saying, I'm wondering? Because in the same way, earthquakes and volcanoes are all part of that evolution, and so
is
evolutionary
biology,
our morals.
Let's keep, I'm going to press ahead now, because I realise we're getting slightly off the track. We'll have more. Raise that question at the end, by all means. So I'm going to press ahead. Free will solution, standard theodicy. If you don't like that one, or you think that one's inadequate, we can look at the character-building type theodicy, or explanation for why evil, why suffering exists. We might say, along with the theologian John Hick, that this is a veil of soul-making. It's kind of a sort of cosmic school or character-building exercise. We do suffer, but not pointlessly. People who have suffered, who've gone through some terrible disease, for example, may come out at the other end and say, you know what, I don't regret that suffering for a minute. It allowed me to grow and develop morally and spiritually. I learnt valuable lessons from my suffering. Somebody the other day gave me the example of riding a bike. He was watching his child riding a bike, and they kept falling off and scuffing their knee. And he thought, shall I rush in and stop them? Because they're suffering. But then he thought wisely, no, I mustn't do that, because eventually they'll get it. And they did, and they felt so good about it that all of that suffering and pain was worthwhile. So you can think of pain and suffering in that kind of way. This pain and suffering gives us opportunities to learn and develop, to help each other. If we took the suffering away, none of that would exist. And that would be a catastrophic loss so far as God is concerned. So that's at least part of the explanation for why pain and suffering exists. It's kind of a no pain, no gain type philosophy, basically. You might raise an eyebrow and say, really? This is a sort of character building exercise? I mean, suppose you go to a school and there's a headmaster who is in the attic looking down, knows everything that's going on. You know that to be true, but you don't know what the headmaster's like. So you attempt to ascertain what he's like by looking at how the school is run. And what you discover is most of the children, very many of the children, are flogged mercilessly within an inch of their lives, apparently for no reason whatsoever, whereas others have fantastic, a tiny proportion, have fantastic rewards. Again, apparently for no reason whatsoever. It's all kind of completely random, so far as you can make out. And indeed, some of the children, you know, graduate, bow out of the school, you know, physically and psychologically devastated and crippled by what they have been put through in this school. Would it be reasonable for you to conclude, or even believe, that the person in charge of this school was supremely benevolent? No, it was perfectly obvious that wouldn't be a reasonable thing for you to believe, given what's in front of you. I mean, you can say, well, perhaps in some way I don't understand, this is really all for the best. But on the face of it, this is fantastically good evidence that whoever is in charge of that school is not supremely benevolent. And if you look at the world, it has much the same character. There is, you know, an enormous amount of suffering meted out in a completely random way, apparently. One or two people get fantastic stuff, health, wealth, and good fortune, but it's all completely random. Mass murdering dictators live their lives in luxury. You know, wonderful, selfless people are given horrible diseases and die in agony. You know, their personality is destroyed by the experience through which they have been put. A grand character building exercise? Well, I don't think so. I just can't see that personally. But you know, I guess it's possible. It's a possibility. If you don't like these kind of explanations, and of course there are many more, you can always play the mystery card. You can say, well, you know, God works in mysterious ways. His wonders to perform. This really is the best of all possible worlds. It's just you, being a mere human being, couldn't possibly understand how this is, after all, the mind of God that we're talking about. You know, infinitely intelligent, limitlessly wise. Of course you're not going to be able to understand everything. Of course you're not going to be able to understand his divine plan. Show a little humility, why don't you? Yeah, this really is all for the best. Just acknowledge your intellectual limitations. So we can play the mystery card too. Many people who believe in God, this particular God, theists, clearly, if they think that their belief is not unreasonable, they think it's halfway up the scale of reasonableness. If you ask them why that's so, given the evidential problem of evil, these are the kinds of explanation which they give you. There are others too, but these are the kinds of explanations, this style of explanation. They will often admit, if they're honest, that of course this doesn't entirely deal with the problem of evil, with the evidential problem of evil. But they think that these kind of moves, or very often they think that these kind of moves, if you kind of put them together, at least begin to bring the problem down to manageable proportions. It's no longer quite the devastating objection or argument that it might have seemed to be when it was initially introduced. Once we've made these various moves, we can begin to see how maybe it's not so unreasonable, after all, to believe in God. And, well, I don't accept that. It seems to me that actually the evidential problem of evil is devastating so far as traditional theism is concerned, and these kinds of moves really don't deal with the problem at all. And so in order to try and explain why I think that, I'm going to give you an analogy, which I suspect some of you have already come across, but anyway, for some of you at least, it will come as a novel approach. And that's to consider the evil God hypothesis. Let's suppose that there's one personal God, in charge of the universe, who created it, who designed it, and this being is all-powerful and supremely evil. His cruelty is without limit. His malice knows no bounds. He's really, really bad, and not in the way Michael Jackson meant. I mean, maximally bad. How reasonable is it to believe in an evil God? Where on the scale of reasonableness should we locate the evil God hypothesis? Now, perhaps we should have a quick poll. Who wants to stick the evil God hypothesis pretty low down on the scale of reasonableness? I'm guessing quite a lot of you. Yeah. Who wants to stick him, hey, halfway up the scale of reasonableness? One or two of you. Yes, interesting. Most of you. Who wants to stick him really high? high on the scale higher. Of reasonableness. Higher.
Yeah, higher.
Higher, okay.
Well, way above the all good one.
Way above the all good one. Okay. Okay, yeah. Maybe not that high, but higher than that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, neither might be higher still.
Yeah. Because there are a number of different God hypotheses we consider. There's the all-good one, all-powerful, all-good. There's the all-powerful, all-evil one. And then there's the all-powerful, morally neutral one, say. Those who stick belief in God, the traditional God, the good God, halfway up the scale of reasonableness will generally stick the evil God hypothesis very low down on the scale of reasonableness. One belief is, oh, that's not unreasonable, whereas the other belief is, oh, you know, pull the other one. Of course there isn't an evil God. But why? Why is it reasonable to suppose that there is no such being? I mean, first of all, as I've already pointed out, notice that the evil God hypothesis is just as well supported by most, I don't say all, but most of, or many of, perhaps I should have said, the standard arguments for the existence of God, such as, you know, the teleological arguments and the cosmological arguments and even the ontological arguments, actually, most of the standard versions, they are simply neutral so far as God's moral properties are concerned. So the evil God hypothesis is as well supported by those kinds of arguments as is the good God hypothesis. So why do we dismiss it then? Why do we consider it to be a joke? Why do we consider it to be a joke? Yes.
Well, there's one factor being left out of the equation throughout all of this course so far. And if you want to leave it out just so this particular argument will run, is one thing.
Okay.
But you keep coming, well, at least I keep coming up all at a time. You know, there's one very good reason for actually believing in the good God.
Yes.
Because if you are a Christian, you will go back to the Bible, not in any fundamentalist sense. And the key element within that is what is the most important law? And Jesus replies, it is love God, love each other. And he also says a number of occasions, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, I'll come back, let's stop there, because I'm going to do exactly what you predicted I would do, to say, I'll come back to that later on. I promise I will actually come back to the role of the Bible, say, in religious belief, or belief with respect to this particular God hypothesis. If I don't come back to it, you nail me and stick your hand up and shout at me, okay? So, no one believes in the evil God hypothesis, or hardly anyone. There were one or two who thought maybe. Why? Because of the evidential problem of good, right? If you believe in a supremely powerful and evil being, you've got some explaining to do, haven't you? What, I mean, I know there is a lot of evil in the world. We've established that already. But boy, there's quite a lot of good stuff. You know, love and laughter and rainbows. Why does that exist if there's a supremely evil being in charge of the universe? Let's go through some examples of good stuff. Why would he give us a lovely view? Why would he create beautiful sunsets and mountains for us to enjoy? Surely an evil God would want to torture us for all eternity with a red-hot poker, not give us a lovely view, a beautiful sunset, or whatever. You're way ahead of me there. Way ahead of me. Why would he give us healthy young bodies? Well, not us, necessarily. Some time back now. Why would he have given us healthy young bodies? Surely he'd want to give us horribly painful, crippled, arthritic, incontinent bodies, permanently in pain. That's the kind of body an evil God would give you. But no, he gives us healthy, fit young bodies so we can frolic around in the sunshine and have fun. Is that the kind of behaviour that you would expect from a supremely evil being? Clearly not. I am coming to those very worries. Why would he give us beautiful children to love? Because children, after all, you know, are all about love. We love them, they love us, unconditional love. Evil God hates love. It makes him want to puke, frankly, love. And so the last thing he's going to want to do is to populate his creation with little bundles of joy that we love unconditionally and love us unconditionally in return. This is just not the kind of behavior that you would expect from an evil being. Why would he allow us to do good deeds and help each other? Why would he allow, you know, Mother Teresa, or choose your own example if you're not so keen on Mother Teresa, Mother Teresa to help people and reduce their suffering? Because evil God likes suffering. He is not going to allow people to go around reducing suffering. He's going to clamp down on that kind of behaviour straight away. So, again, powerful evidence that there's no such being. Why would he bestow upon some people fantastic wealth, good fortune, happiness? David Beckham comes to mind. You know, a new Ferrari a week, multi-billion-dollar contracts, beautiful wife and lovely kids, and he's healthy, well, most of the time. Why would an evil God behave like that towards David? Surely he would torture David Beckham for all eternity with a red-hot poker? But no, we find that that's not what happened. So isn't this all excellent evidence that there's no evil God? I'm running the evidential problem of good against the evil God hypothesis, which is merely the mirror version of the evidential problem of evil as run against the good God hypothesis. And actually, when we run the evidential problem of good against the evil God hypothesis, we can see, boy, this is really good evidence, isn't it? Really, really good evidence against the evil God hypothesis. But suppose I were to say, you know, I think you're being hasty. I think you're being far too hasty in rejecting this evidence, because what about this? free will. An evil God could have made us puppet beings who always did the wrong thing, couldn't he? Why didn't he then? Because if he doesn't give us free will, if he doesn't give us a free choice, we won't have moral responsibility. If we don't have moral responsibility, that moral evil cannot exist. And moral evil is the most important form of evil that there is, of course. People knowingly doing wrong of their own volition. So in order to have the really important kind of evil in his creation, evil God had to give us free will. The downside to that is that he's sometimes Mother Teresa goes around helping people. But that's the price evil God has to pay for that very important form of evil existing in his creation. So you can see what I've done. I have simply taken a standard theodicy and I've flipped it. And you can have fun flipping theodicies. In this way, I'll flip some more for you. So this one is the reverse free will defense. Also, I might add, to bolster it a bit, if God gives us free will, that also allows him to, or at least the illusion of it, which is probably all we've got anyway, frankly, it allows him to mess with our minds. As the lady at the back pointed out, it's going to get pretty boring torturing us for all eternity with a red-hot poker. How much more fun for evil God to actually introduce certain psychological, more sophisticated psychological forms of suffering into his creation, such as temptation, the agony of temptation. Well, I really, really want that, but well, I know I shouldn't do it. And we'll sit there torturing ourselves, the irony. It's because we know we've got free will, or at least we think we do. So that's another win, another bonus for evil God. And then after we've succumbed to temptation, because evil God gave us weak and selfish natures, we then feel guilt. Again, we torture ourselves with guilt because we know we could have done otherwise. So there are many benefits, so far as evil God is concerned, in giving us free will. It allows for moral evil. It allows for certain important psychological forms of suffering which otherwise can't exist. That's why it exists. You may say, well, look, that only goes so far in explaining the good stuff. So then I'll add another theodicy. This is not a veil of soul-making. This is a veil of soul-destruction. There are goods put into the world. Why? Because they allow God to torture us more. They give him opportunities which otherwise would not be available to him. Why would he create natural beauty? Well, as a contrast, obviously. I mean, you know, you can't appreciate just how disgusting or bad some things are unless you've been shown something good. So evil God had to pepper his creation with some beauty in order to make our appreciation of the dreariness and ghastliness of day-to-day life all the more acute. That's why the beauty is there. Again, I'm just flipping a standard Christian type theodicy. You've probably heard this one, the reverse version of this, 100 times before. Why does he give us children? Well, for the obvious reason that it's only if you really, really, really care about something that you can really, really, really be made to worry about it. That kind of anguish, which only a parent knows, is only available to an evil God if he gives us something that we love unconditionally. So, of course, he's going to populate the world with these little bundles of joy. Why does he give us healthy, fit, young bodies? Yes, for about 10 or 15 years, and then slowly and inevitably, I really got carried away on this one, they slide into decay, disease, and decrepitude until we end up hopelessly ugly, incontinent, and smelling of wee, and then we die, having lived out a short and ultimately meaningless existence. The reason why we get the good stuff early is so that he can then take it away. Slowly and inexorably. You know, how much more cruel than if you just give them the bad thing to begin with?
That.
You're coming around, yes. So by giving us something new, something great, and snatching it away, evil God can make us suffer even more than if we never had it. Why does David Beckham get the new Ferrari every week? It's pretty obvious, really, when you think about it. Some people get lavish lifestyles, a few, good health and success, to make the rest of us feel bad. I mean, it's obvious, isn't it? Who can rest content when they have so much, you comparatively have so little, you know that no matter how hard you work, you will never have that, you know that they don't deserve it. It's a recipe for endless, you know, mental anguish and torment. You're unsatisfied with your lot, you're constantly... Yes?
I don't agree. If you are staying with Bethlehem, I don't think you would stay with Bethlehem.
Well, this is... I was just coming to this. Yeah. It's a win-win actually situation for evil God, because actually deep down, even David Beckham isn't really happy. He just... He's not. So you can see that it's all beginning to make sense, and that Hello Magazine is all part then of evil God's master plan to make the earth a living hell. This is all... See, you're coming round to the idea. So, if you don't like these various theodicies which I've constructed, which are merely flipped standard theodicies, notice, I can play the mystery card. You know, you arrogant bunch of what's-its, you know, thinking that you could know the mind of God. This really is the worst of all possible worlds. It's just that you, being mere human beings, can't possibly understand how. These goods are all for the worst, but, you know, show a little humility, why don't you? Of course you're not going to be able to understand everything. You're not going to be able to explain everything. It's necessarily going to be beyond your ken, as Stephen Wackstra, I think you pronounce his name, he wrote a paper trying to deal with the problem of evil by suggesting that, of course, we're not going to be able to understand everything. Of course, there are going to be many things that we can't explain. And so that's why the evidential problem of evil, well, it's not such a big problem, really. Well, I'll just do the Wykstra move here and say, you know, the problem of good, not such a big problem, really. Of course, it's all going to make sense in the end. It's just that we can't understand how. How am I doing for time, Maria?
We finish at 10:45.
Okay, not too good, but not too bad. So here's my conclusion. Is anyone persuaded by, well, some of you, maybe you are, but is anyone persuaded by these reverse theodicies? And the answer is, yeah.
I think they're exactly parallel, as you say, but missed out some important things which would really skew the picture.
Well, we can come to those in a minute. Because I think you're right, there are some things we haven't talked about, which we need to talk about. But let's just take a step back at this point and look at the scale of reasonableness. Now, again, okay? So we said, evil God, low down on the scale of reasonableness, mainly because of the evidential problem of good. But those who believe in God want to put the good God hypothesis at least halfway up the scale of reasonableness. The question, the challenge now, is to explain, well, why, if one belief is just a joke, I mean, and it is quite literally a joke, why is the other one, not unreasonable? By no means is that an unreasonable thing to believe, that there's an all-powerful, all-good God. Right? How do you account for that discrepancy? The onus now is on the theist to explain why they hold such differing attitudes, to justify those differing positions that they're assigning those two beliefs on the scale of reasonableness. They have to do the explaining now, and I want to hear the explanations. And so far, I haven't heard a good one. So you can give me a go. So I'm not saying I have proved that there's no God. What I'm saying is, I personally think that, you know, it's pretty ridiculous, frankly, to believe in an evil God, because there's overwhelming empirical evidence against it. It's fairly straightforwardly empirically falsified, the evil God hypothesis. It seems to me that the good God hypothesis is also pretty straightforwardly empirically falsified. Most of the standard arguments for the good God turn out to be just as good arguments for the evil God, i.e. not very. So the question then is, well, so why do we consider one belief so much more reasonable than the other one? And so far as I'm concerned, it isn't. I mean, I just can't see why one belief is significantly more reasonable than the other one. However, so there appears to be a symmetry here, a rough symmetry. I don't claim it's perfect. You may say, well, one is a little bit more reasonable than the other. Perhaps you're right. I'll look at some reasons why that might be true. But just, even if they are slightly different on the scale of reasonableness, if they're both right down the bottom, who cares? they're still both highly unreasonable, and we are justified in rejecting both of them. What we might not be justified in doing at this point is saying there is no kind of God at all. I mean, Dawkins' God hypothesis, that there is some intelligence, but, you know, leaving out the moral properties, could be morally neutral. We have no objection whatsoever here against that God hypothesis. You might maintain that that one is still much higher on the scale of reasonableness and would have to run some other arguments against that God hypothesis. But so far as the God as traditionally conceived and the evil God hypothesis, they're both looking like they're in big, big trouble, rationally speaking. So that's my conclusion. It's a challenge, really. People dismiss the evil God hypothesis as silly, yet we're supposed to be taking the good God hypothesis seriously. Let me very quickly say this. I forgot I was going to add this. Look, there is a mystery about why the universe exists. I agree. Some people say, look, either you must deny that there's a mystery and claim you have all the answers, or you've got to allow that you can't solve it, and then that my God might exist. Well, that doesn't follow at all. Just because, you know, suppose Sherlock Holmes is having a bad day, he can't solve the mystery. He can't say who done it. It doesn't follow that he can't be very justifiably sure that certain individual didn't, right? If that person was in the room with him at the time, say. You can be very, very justified. It can be very, very reasonable for you to believe that a certain hypothesis is false, even if you don't know what the answer to the question actually is. So atheists can be honest and say, I don't know. I'm the one showing a little humility here. I'm the one saying, I don't know what the answer to the question is. But I can be sure that certain answers are incorrect. And I have excellent evidence that they are incorrect. And the evil God hypothesis, that's definitely incorrect. Excellent empirical evidence that that is not true. But then why isn't there excellent empirical evidence that the good God hypothesis is false as well? We've done that already, and then you should all buy my book, obviously. and the academic version of what I've just done is available in Religious Studies, the journal Religious Studies, which is what it sounds like, a journal of philosophy of religion, basically. there's an academic version. If you want a copy of it, I could send you a PDF if you email me, and you can get my email address off my blog, stephenlaw.org, Stephen with a PH. So if anyone wants a copy of that, the academic version, which is a bit more worked out than the slightly jokey knockabout version I've just given you, I will happily do that. So questions now. Yes?
Earlier on, the gentleman back there said that God lives within us. This seems to me like the argument of Bishop Robinson. Why can't we just say the person, the God that lives within us is goodness? He's just goodness, and I call it God.
Yes.
Yes. As far as I understand it, that is what the greatest thing, that there is good in all of us, and this is all.
Yes, I mean, if you define God as goodness, I'll agree that, yeah, probably God exists. but that wasn't the God hypothesis that we were discussing. Yeah. Yes?
Sort of depending on how you define your good and evil,
yeah.
All the evils we're talking about are located on this one tiny planet in one tiny corner of the universe. And the rest of the universe could be described as being good in that it's well-ordered,
but there's no one to look at it. So it is accessible to us then.
So it's accessible, but,
yeah.
But the evil that we're using, sorry, I'm not saying I...
Yeah.
What
okay.
I'm saying is the evil we're considering and using as a proof against a good God is located in one tiny corner. We know that. It's only accessible to us.
We don't really know, because I mean, if there's life on other planets and evolution's going on other planets,
trying to look at empirical evidence.
Yeah, it's by no. Yeah, well, I mean, some people think that's extremely likely. I put it halfway up the scale of reasonableness, you know, that there was intelligent life out there. So, so one of your premises looks rather suspect already. But anyway, carry on.
That's all I'm saying is that the evil we're using
God created the universe, the evil we're using is all ours. It's all located here. You're not locating it anywhere else.
Yeah.
And yet the good is located throughout.
Well, we just don't know that that's... The question is, even if that were true, though, the fact that there is so much here is extremely good evidence that there's no such being, surely. I mean, the fact that it doesn't extend into the rest of the universe, perhaps it does, actually. But even if it didn't, you might still have more than enough here to be sure that there is no such being. I mean, in the example, maybe I could modify one of my examples of the school, the headmaster. Suppose that in much of the school, you know, it's kind of neutral, but there is a particular corner where the children are tortured mercilessly. Is it reasonable for me to believe that this school is run by a supremely benevolent headmaster who is in control of everything? No. The mere fact that in that corner there is the most horrific stuff going on, an awful lot of it, despite the fact it's not going on in the rest of the school, that by itself is excellent evidence that the headmaster is not supremely benevolent. So I'm not at all persuaded by that. And in any case, it begs the question whether there is no suffering out there in the rest of the cosmos. Yes, that lady right at the back who...
I'm not sure that you have exactly reversed the situations. I agree with you. As you've done it, there is a good symmetry and all your argument runs.
Yeah.
But I would think that an all-powerful, all-loving God, or any all-evil God, built in, we also have an idea of God always, whatever it is, that God wants you to do what he, she, whatever, considers right. But here you did give one example. This evil God, say, this hypothesis of an evil God, makes us suffer from temptation. And after we've done something bad, we feel terribly guilty. Now, I think you're assuming that good is good, even in a world made by an evil God. Because if we've done evil in an evil God's world, we wouldn't feel guilty. We'd feel we'd done the right thing. And in a good God's world...
It depends on your particular theory about good and evil as a theist. Because some are... Well, there are various theories. There's the divine command theory, which it sounds like you're coming close to signing up to, which is that what is good is just what God commands us to do.
As a sort of churchgoer and probably Christian, I don't believe in evil at all, but I'm using the word because you are.
Yeah, well, as I say, I can run the entire thing without even mentioning the word, actually. I think the best shot at finding an asymmetry probably does involve focusing on moral concepts. So I spend some time in the academic version of the paper looking at that. There are some asymmetries, actually, as I acknowledge, in the paper. However, some of the... here's an interesting one, which I really should give you. You might say, and Richard Swinburne pointed this out to me, it wasn't that I hadn't already thought of it, actually, but Richard Swinburne pointed out to me that there are arguments for the existence of God, obviously, which are not actually neutral so far as God's moral properties are concerned. And the obvious examples are the argument from miracles. You know, God performs miracles, and he performs nice ones. He cures people. He doesn't do bad stuff miraculously. And also religious experience. God appears to us in experiences, and they are positive experiences, not negative experiences. Now, actually, I think we could question both of those claims, because you might say, well, let's take religious experiences, for example, that they're always positive. Actually, it turns out that quite a lot of people do have a sense that there is something fundamentally evil behind the universe. But when they express that attitude, they tend to be put on medication. Whereas when they express the feeling that there's something fundamentally good behind the universe, they tend to be given a dog collar. Right? So So possibly there is actually even a symmetry here. But let's suppose that there isn't. Let's suppose that people only have a good positive experience or sense that there's something good behind the universe. Does that show that, is that evidence for a good God over an evil God? Does that really shift things on the scale, push the good God up the scale of reasonableness? I'm not sure, because if I were an evil God, this is what I would do. I would go to these people over here, and I would put on my white outfit and my halo, and I would appear to them in a vision of goodness. I would be a deceiver God, you see. And I would do some miracles, so they would know it was me, the one true God. You know, they're going to be convinced now, right? Because I cured some people miraculously, and then I'll tell them some stuff. And then I'll go to these people over here, and I'll say, I am your God, the one true God, with my halo on and my white outfit, and I'll do some miracles. So they'll know it's me, they'll be utterly convinced, and I'll tell them some stuff that directly contradicts what I told them. And then I'll just stand back. And the result is entirely predictable. This is a recipe for endless horror, isn't it? As the two sides go to war against each other, each absolutely now convinced that they have the one true God on their side. They will do the most disgusting and depraved things now to each other, knowing that they're doing it for God. And now, if you look at how religious experiences and miracles are actually distributed, well, that's kind of how they're distributed, isn't it? I mean, you know, these people have these experiences, those people have those experiences, they have their miracles, they believe this, they don't believe that, they believe something else. If I was the one true God, the last thing I would be doing is distributing miracles and religious experiences in that way. But that is exactly what I would do if I were an evil God. So arguably, miracles and religious experiences are better evidence for an evil God than a good God. We should not, at this point, rule out the possibility that there is an asymmetry and the evil God hypothesis is actually the more reasonable of the two hypotheses.
So yeah. The evil God's miracle is to make people ill.
Yeah. Yes, doesn't possibly, by supernatural... Yes. Yeah. I mean, there are all sorts of... When bad stuff happens, we say, oh, that's just bad luck, and when good stuff happens, we say, oh, that was a miracle. That's... Okay. Have we got to stop? We have to stop. Yeah. So you can grill me. There will be a whole hour of grilling of me and my... and Marianne as well after the break. Yes, thank you. Thank you.